It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today with film critics Amy Nicholson, who writes for The Guardian and hosts the podcast Unspooled and the new podcast miniseries Zoom, and Justin Chang, Los Angeles Times film critic. We begin with Jordan Peele's new movie, the writer-director back after Get Out. This horror film stars Lupita Nyong'o and Winston Duke. The movie is about a Northern California family whose life is turned upside down when a group of doppelgangers begins to terrorize them.
What are you people?
It's us.
They look exactly like us. They think like us. They know where we are. We need to move and keep moving. They won't stop until they kill us. And we kill them.
Us from Jordan Peele. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, Jordan Peele has made the most anticipated horror film of the year. I think the song I've Got Five on It has been in people's heads ever since he dropped the first trailer for Us. And after all of that buildup, the film itself is fine. It's a kind of slight horror film that I think throws a lot of allusions to all of the films that he loves in the past. There's a touch of Lost Boys in it. There's a touch of sort of a mystery box, what's going to really happen in this creepy town where all of these doppelgangers are showing up. And I love the performances in this, and I was not super sold on the script, to be honest. Like, I feel with Jordan Peele, like, as a comedian, he was always this voice of the future. Like, he was bringing comedy forward. And when he makes horror films, I can't help but think he's just making so many allusions to the films he's loved in the past. And I'm ready for him to really be his own voice now.
Well, in Get Out, though, I thought he just beautifully walked that line between flat-out comedy and horror. And he just... he struck that note to me so perfectly in Get Out. Justin, what'd you think of Us?
Yeah, I think that Get Out is the better film by far. I like Us better than Amy does, but I understand what she's talking about in terms of script weaknesses. There may be so many ideas and there's so much ambition to the movie that he might have productively pared it down a little bit more. One of the virtues of Get Out, I think, was just how conceptually clean it was. You know, it was like white liberal racism is the boogeyman. And it's like from there, the movie kind of falls into place. What I like about this one is I think he's become a better and more committed director of horror. I think he brings real filmmaking chops. There's a lot of ideas and subtext at play in this story. You know, the doppelgangers, the enemy is us. You know, we've seen the enemy, and he's, you know, literal. Like, it's a literalization of that idea, and I think it's productive to just put that almost aside and just submit to the what's going to happen next pleasure of it. And there's a lot of, just in terms of sculpting B movie thrills, in terms of using everyday objects to generate tension, in terms of, you know, sending the skittering shadows across a wall or in the background. I think he has a lot of formal talent that comes through. And Lupita Nyong'o's performance, a dual performance, a lot of people are giving dual performances in this movie because there's a lot of doppelgangers, but her performance holds the key to the whole movie. And as great an actress as we've known Lupita Nyong'o is, I don't think she's done anything like what she does here.
Yeah, but Amy, it just didn't come together for you.
It didn't. I mean, I enjoy seeing Lupita Nyong'o's horror turn. She was also in this movie called Little Monsters at Sundance, where she battled a bunch of child zombies. And here she gets to stretch a little bit more than be like a sweet kindergartner who's attacking bloody kids. But I think for me, I was really taken with the performances, for sure. I thought they're all excellent. I think the physical part of the performances is even better. There's a kid, Evan Alex. He's the youngest son. And the doppelganger who plays him, who may be him, it's under a mask, I can't quite tell, is so creepy in the way he moves his fingers, his legs, his knees. Every time Jordan Peele just concentrates on that, the spidery movement that he makes his cast do, I was absolutely in love with it.
I'm getting goosebumps as you describe it, Amy. That's really good.
Well, then maybe I'll just come over and describe the movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, right. Yeah, that's right.
There's a wonderful physicality to the performances. And Winston Duke, who, funnily enough, played opposite Lupita Nyong'o as they were fellow Wakandans in Black Panther, and here they're playing this married couple, he is giving an almost purely comedic performance. And one of the things I like about this movie, and that I also liked about Get Out, was that Jordan Peele has this uncanny balance of horror and humor, and he's making satirical points, and he is also making you laugh, and he's making you scream, and he's kind of weaponizing your laughter. And he really, to me, makes laughing and screaming and thinking about what you're laughing and screaming about all they're not mutually exclusive pleasures.
Yeah. We're talking about Peele's new film, Us. He's the writer-director. Lupita Nyong'o and Winston Duke are the stars of the film. It's rated R. It's in wide release. The film Hotel Mumbai stars Dev Patel, Armie Hammer. It's directed by Anthony Morris, and it's written by Morris with John Cawley. Justin, what do you think of Hotel Mumbai?
I think this is a very well-staged and often suspenseful movie that, like a lot of dramatic reenactments of terrorist acts, I don't think justifies its existence in the end. It compresses the devastating events of November 2008, which lasted several days and killed more than 160 people in Mumbai, into a movie that seems to play out over several hours. There were widespread coordinated attacks at 12 different sites across the whole city, but the movie focuses on the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel, which is this beautiful luxury hotel. The focus in itself is somewhat troubling. It feels very strategic and calculating. It's, this is where you can film in a closed single location. This is where you're going to find the most international visitors, where you can cast well-known actors like Armie Hammer and Jason Isaacs as hotel guests. I do think the filmmakers have tried to do a scrupulous job in registering heroism amid the chaos, especially from the hotel staff, many of whom stayed behind to help their guests. So Dev Patel is kind of the star of the movie, playing a waiter who is very, very heroic and self-sacrificing. But I can concede, like, the craft of the movie, how well it's staged, and even give the filmmakers the benefit of the doubt with their intentions. I just am really queasy about a movie that recreates these real events in ways that basically give us a lot of extras, and some of them are based on real people, some of them are composite characters, and just turns them into machine gun fodder. It's a very disturbing, excruciating movie to watch. And I think it's a little problematic the way we get to know the survivors intimately, and then they're just random people who die and we don't, and it's almost like the people who survived are more inherently worthy of dramatization. I know the intention of these movies, and even ones that have been made well, like Paul Greengrass's United 93 and 22 July, you know, those are very good, well-made movies. I know that the intention is to honor and memorialize. When you're doing this kind of minute-by-minute, sweaty palms kind of dramatization, I don't think it's a very honoring or honorable thing in the end. I just don't.
Really? Even with you? Because I felt like with Greengrass's United 93 that he really brought us up close to the people who died. And I didn't feel like you're describing with Hotel Mumbai that there were, that the people were fodder or everybody's lives really mattered.
Absolutely.
In United 93.
I think United 93 is probably the one that problematizes my reaction to these movies the most, because Greengrass is so good at this and because he really makes you feel the value of human life in that movie. There are still decisions that he makes that kind of give me pause, but he's also operating on a level of technical craft, Greengrass is, that I just don't think this movie really has. There's also the bad timing issue. I mean, coming so soon after the massacres in Christchurch, New Zealand, and given that every movie that opens now is sadly in proximity to some tragedy of that nature, it makes me question the existence of these movies all the more.
Hotel Mumbai is the film from director and co-writer Anthony Morris. Dev Patel, Armie Hammer star in the film. It's rated R at the Landmark in West L.A. and at the Arclight in Hollywood. Next on Film Week, the French romantic thriller Knife and Heart. It stars Vanessa Paradis, and it's directed by Jan Gonzalez, who co-wrote the screenplay with Cristiano Mangionet. What do you think, Amy, of Knife Plus Heart?
Well, if you crossed your eyes and drank a lot, you might think you stumbled into an old Brian De Palma movie, one of the lesser Brian De Palmas that are just sadistic and stylish, because this film is both of those
body
things.
Body double or something like that.
Exactly. You know, what this film is about is Vanessa Paradis, who people might know, she was Johnny Depp's ex-wife. She was a Chanel model for a very long time. She plays a porn producer who specializes in making, like, in gay porn and casting young men from construction sites and turning them into stars. And then her men start getting killed one at a time. And it's sort of a detective story, except she doesn't really seem to get it together that much to really begin investigating. She's more caught up in her relationship with her ex-girlfriend and wondering what she's going to do to get her love life back on track, even though she's aggressive and messy. My big problem with it is that the film has a big heart sometimes for the men in the movies who are the victims, and yet the deaths are so sadistic and so brutal. There's people who get stabbed with sex toys shoved in their mouth that have knives inserted in the middle, and it cannot have it both ways. I found myself getting so angry because I was loving these men and then watching them get killed in a way that didn't have the empathy I feel like it should have.
Justin, what do you think of Knife and Heart?
Yeah, I didn't care for it either, maybe for different reasons. I think there's a lot of fun elements here. I like Vanessa Paradis' performance. You know, she's trying to cast these hunky male actors from the common people, like a kind of porn neorealist. And, you know, there's nice 35mm photography and this throbbing electronic soundtrack, and you have this playful, affectionate portrait of how a vintage porn set works, if you're interested in that kind of thing. A lot of talent here. I just think it's really incoherent and tonally all over the place.
We're talking about Knife and Heart. It's at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. Jan Gonzalez is the director and co-screenwriter of the film. It's unrated. It's obviously for adults only. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Justin Chang and Amy Nicholson. Next up, the Hungarian film Sunset from writer-director Laszlo Nemes. It stars Yuli Jakob and Suzanne West. Justin, what do you think of Sunset?
I think it's a really difficult and challenging, beautiful movie that should be seen and maybe even seen twice. It's also a follow-up to Son of Saul, Hungarian director Laszlo Nemes' previous film, and it, for me, asked the question, when you've made sort of the ultimate film about Auschwitz, about being in a death camp, and you've won an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film, where do you go from there? And what Nemes has done is he has taken some of the very stylized but very raw formal elements of Son of Saul and transplanted them to the world of pre-World War I Hungary. We're in Budapest in the 1910s, and you are following this woman who you don't really know who she is. She is in a hat shop that apparently once belonged to her parents, who died when she was just a child, and she is applying for a job. The minute they find out who she is and that she has some lineage here, connection to this this hat shop, they turn her away. And everyone in the movie, it's a quest movie. She's trying to find, you know, she's trying to find out things about her family. She's trying to secure this job. Everyone distrusts her. And the movie is shot in much the same way that Son of Saul was, where the background is a blur and you are following this character sometimes closely behind her head. And she's wearing a lot of beautiful hats. There's beautiful hats in this movie. And sometimes you're just
it's
looking
at
it.
Right?
It's a hat. It's very central. And the movie is in some ways very much about the evil and the horror that lurks behind beautiful things, behind the trappings of wealth and aristocracy. This is a movie about the Hungarian aristocracy. And at this time, this was the pinnacle of European life, of cultural refinement. And it's all about how this kind of decadent, sophisticated era vanished and was subsumed in the horrors of World War I. And yet all of that is very, very sort of dense and metaphorically layered throughout the movie, because through this, you're just wondering, what is she doing? Where is she going? And long tracking shots that are very that are almost not broken. And so it is both mesmerizing and maddening, and I had to see it a couple times to get a handle of the plot.
Wow.
If that's your thing, I do recommend it, though, because I think the filmmaking is pretty bravura.
All right. Sunset, the film from director Laszlo Nemes, who co-wrote the screenplay. The Hungarian film is at Lemley's Royal in West L.A., rated R. The mystery drama Dragged Across Concrete stars Mel Gibson, Vince Vaughn, Michael J. White, and Tori Kittles. It's written and directed by S. Craig Zoller. Justin?
Zoller is a really interesting filmmaker whom I have liked a lot in the past, and maybe still do, although this movie made me feel a little bit worse for having liked him in the past, because I think he's very much a genre auteur, and he loves kind of repurposing B-movies and cop movie cliches, and adding and drawing them out. This movie runs about 2 hours and 40 minutes or so. It stars Mel Gibson as a casually racist, grizzled police detective, and Vince Vaughn as his partner. So you have, you know, a little bit play on Lethal Weapon, sort of, you know, with a crooked cop duo, who are suspended because they have roughed up a suspect, and also in a really difficult to watch scene, thrown a half deaf Latina suspect into a shower and mistreated her. And so this is a movie where it basically is putting these characters' bad behavior out there, and there's a hint of reactionary politics at work here, because you have Mel Gibson, who is obviously for a lot of people a problematic figure, giving voice to his sense that, oh, I wish things were just, I wish we didn't live in this such a politically correct age. And so the movie, if you are, you know, depending on your inclination, is sort of has this trolling aspect, and it's so it, but then it's drawn out, it's long, and it's punctuated by spasms of extraordinarily brutal violence as these two cops decide to intercept a bank robbery and steal the money themselves, and all hell breaks loose. There's a lot of characters in this movie. Amy, I'm going to let you take this away because there's so much going on in this 2 hour and 40 minute
Dragged
movie.
Across concrete, the film.
Yeah, there's so much going on. And this is a film that I was looking forward to, as was Justin, I think, because of Craig Zoller's last film, Brawl in Cellblock 99, like, where Vince Vaughn played a man who goes to prison and basically has to fight his way to save some bad guys from giving his wife a forcible abortion. These are the politics that Craig Zoller likes to work in. And this film feels as reactionary in 2019 as like Dirty Harry would have in 1971. It feels dirty and angry, and it feels like it wants to pick a fight with you. You know, there's a scene where, you know, the plot just stops so that Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn and their commanding officer can have a talk about how people just have these cell phones and it's getting people in trouble, and how does somebody get redeemed nowadays anyways? And all you're thinking about is Mel Gibson being videotaped or being recorded saying horrible things to a Jewish police officer. And so the film just knows that that's what's happening. And it leans into it. But I'm not sure what exactly it wants to say, except for he wasn't that bad of a guy, or can you forgive him a little?
Yeah, and it's trying to push your buttons. And yet, the thing, I almost wish it would commit to it more, because then it feels like a sort of disingenuous pose. Like, I don't know what Zoller's politics are. I have some idea, but he's very vague about it. And then he introduces these other characters who are almost but not quite as important as Gibson and Vaughn. Tori Kittles, who plays, an ex-con who's just gotten out of prison, and he is part of the bank robbery because he has to support his mom and his disabled younger brother. So
Everybody in here, by the way, has a disabled relative. Everyone for extra pathos.
It's about like working class despair. What happens when you don't have enough money? And here it's almost like he's bringing in this black character who also becomes sympathetic, and you develop a rooting interest. And so it's playing these different factions off each other in a way that dares you to hate this movie. And I think if you do, you've almost fallen into its trap. So
Dragged Across Concrete, a lot going on. Mel Gibson, Vince Vaughn, Tori Kittles, S. Craig Zoller, the writer-director. It's rated R, and it's on screen at the Arclight in Hollywood. Out of Blue, a mystery drama starring Patricia Clarkson, Mamie Gummer, James Caan, and Jackie Weaver are in the cast. It's based on Martin Amis's Night Train. Carol Morley is the writer-director of the film. Justin?
Kind of liked this movie, even though I don't think it entirely or even partially works, maybe. It's a beguilingly loopy adaptation of that novel, which is, you know, a 1997 detective fiction comic parody almost by Martin Amis. The ever-reliable Patricia Clarkson stars as a New Orleans detective investigating the homicide of an astrophysicist who's played by Mamie Gummer and who was found shot to death in her observatory. The victim is known for her pioneering research on black holes, and this movie kind of goes into a black hole of its own. Clarkson's detective starts investigating. There are various clues, like what is this pot of skin cream doing here? But then she starts making these inquiries into dark matter and Schrodinger's cat. And this movie entertains a lot of mind-bending subjects that you would more often find in a quantum physics class than in a murder mystery. And the director, Carol Morley, sustains this vibe of low-key, quasi-Lynchian weirdness throughout. And it's just enough to keep you engaged, although your mileage really may vary. Clarkson, I could watch her in almost anything.
Yeah, she's so good.
She tamps down things a lot, but it's still very welcome to have her presence here. And there are scenes-dealing performances from James Caan and Jackie Weaver. Weaver has this really weird scene where she's like eating chicken wings, and it's the weirdest, funniest, most lip-smacking non-sequitur of a scene I've seen in a while.
How does she do that? She's always so interesting to watch.
I could have watched Jackie Weaver eat chicken wings for the whole movie.
Out of Blue, the film from writer-director Carol Morley. Patricia Clarkson stars. It's unrated at the Monica Film Center, Lemley's Theater in Santa Monica. The documentary Tigerland takes us to India. It's directed by Ross Kaufman. Amy?
Yeah, you might be expecting a feel-bad documentary about the decimation of the tiger population that we've seen in the last century, which is very true and very real, and what is exactly has happened. But what the directors of Tigerland are interested in is the relationship between politics and the tiger population. So they focus in two places. They focus in India and they focus in Russia. And what they're looking at is how the fall of the USSR contributed to a huge skyrocketing rush of tiger poaching, and also how colonialism encouraged a lot of tiger poaching in India. And so it's seeing how the history of these countries shaped what the ecologists who it follows are trying to help today. And it does some things trying to find momentum in the present day. Like there's a group of Russian environmentalists who are on the hunt for these two tiger cubs to try to capture them and tag them before they start eating enough of the villagers' dogs in Russia that the villagers will go after them. And at one point, the Russian scientist who's sort of our lead looks at the camera and he's like, is this where you want me to cry? You know, because he might suspect that this is the sort of film that we would think he was in. I'm saying all this because I think I was dreading watching it, to be honest, because I was terrified of seeing dead tigers. And there are a few dead tigers in here. There's a lot of tiger skins. There's a lot of burned tiger skins from when they capture them and then say nobody will make money off of this.
Like they do with ivory that they're able to recover.
Exactly, exactly. But the film doesn't go for the heartstrings as much as it just goes for a clear look at politics and how the things, the choices that happen in this part of the country affect what happens to the animals over here. And there's some really kind of loving moments where they get into the tourism industry, which is good and bad, especially in the reserves in India. But you get to see these young children who are growing up and being guides themselves. They're like 8, 9, 10, and they know all the plants, and they're so excited to show you their world. And it just makes you wish that we could keep that world together.
So there are, it sounds like there are highly inspirational things along with the environmental tragedy that's also the story.
There is. It's not so much of a mind scrambler as, say, Trophy was, the documentary that came out last year about trophy hunting, where I left thinking I knew, or I started the film thinking I knew how I felt about trophy hunting and left feeling like I didn't know enough to even have an opinion. This has very clear opinions, and it shows so much just how much humans have revered the tiger through history in art. It does a beautiful montage of just all this tiger art dating back centuries. It's really lovely.
Tigerland, the documentary. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center. And then starting next weekend, you can see it on TV's Discovery Channel, also streaming on their app over this weekend. The film is directed by Ross Kaufman, and it's unrated. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with Amy Nicholson and Justin Chang joining us to talk all about this week's movies. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with our critics Justin Chang and Amy Nicholson. Next up, the Chinese drama An Elephant Sitting Still. It's written and directed by Hu Bo in a feature writing and directing debut. Justin, what'd you think?
I loved this movie, and it's in talking about it, it's like, how do I sell you on a four-hour bleak Chinese film? Except to say that for me, it didn't have a boring moment.
There's an intermission in four hours.
There might be. I don't know. I mean, I did give myself an intermission, but which is necessary. But I'm curious about how they're going to present it. But it's very absorbing, and it's sad for reasons even apart from the movie itself. Hu Bo was 29 years old when he took his own life in 2017. Shortly before, or perhaps after, the film was completed, and then the film played at the Berlin International Film Festival the next year. And this is his first and last feature. And I think that would have heralded him as a really exciting new voice in Chinese independent filmmaking. The movie takes place in this gloomy industrial town in northern China, and it follows four different characters who live in the city as they sort of walk around, and their paths occasionally intersect. But this is not a movie like Babel or Crash, you know, those kinds of narratives where you're juggling multiple characters, and it's not some portentous statement about how we're all connected and we're all fated to keep running into each other. This movie actually emphasizes isolation, and occasionally, even though their paths do overlap, you get a profound sense of how alone they are. You have a young high school girl who is having an affair with a school administrator and the shame that ensues when that comes out. You have a high schooler who's being bullied and fights back against the bully with tragic consequences. You have a mid-level gangster who is having an affair with his best friend's wife, and that has tragic consequences. And you have an older man who is being forced by his daughter and son-in-law to move out of their apartment into a retirement home. And he's walking, and he has only his dog for company. this is a city where nothing works. It really captures the mood of a place where jobs and prospects are scarce, where infrastructure is like non-existent.
Is the city, you know, identified?
It is. I'm trying to recall if it was. There is a city that is mentioned, but it is not this city, actually. I believe it is nameless. I could be wrong. There is a reference to a city in Inner Mongolia called Manzuli, where this elephant of the title, it's still sitting elephant, is, and it becomes this sort of metaphor for a creature, this strange creature that who is also persecuted because people are sticking their forks in the, you know, and stabbing at it, and yet it's this creature that's entirely at rest and somewhat impervious to the suffering. And so they talk about wanting to go to the city and see the elephant, and it's about escaping the horrible misery and drudgery of their hopeless existences. And yet for all this, I found it weirdly hopeful. I found it really moving. It's a overpoweringly sad experience, and yet not an entirely hopeless one for the viewer, at least.
Wow.
Yeah.
An Elephant Sitting Still, the film from the late writer-director Hu Bo. Amy, how did you react to this film?
I wanted to love it for all the reasons that I hear Justin describing, and it feels like it is a shame upon me and my family that I could not connect to it.
I wanted
to connect to it, but I am the monster who could not get into the four-hour tragic movie as much as I really, really wanted to. So I feel shame, and I feel like I should give it another shot, but then I also feel like I should not.
4 hours, a lot to give to it, to give it another shot. Can you explain a little bit more, Justin, just because it sounds so depressing.
Yeah, it does.
What did you grab onto that was sort of the...
The thing that I grabbed onto is, oddly enough, the camera work. There's exquisite camera work in this movie. And it's funny to note, this week is seeing two films that are opening this week, An Elephant Sitting Still and Sunset, both made by disciples of the great Hungarian filmmaker Béla Tarr. Laszlo Nemes was his first assistant director on a film. Hu Bo was a student of Tarr's. And Béla Tarr was known for this movie, by the way, An Elephant Sitting Still, is much closer to Tarr's aesthetic, although it's its own beast. Gliding camera work, slowly, you know, beautifully long, unbroken shots. And Tarr's work is very difficult. And this movie, while difficult in certain ways, I think it really pulls you in. The camera, like, will float behind their heads. The camera will sort of glide alongside them, and it will go follow them up staircases. And somehow it's these moments of silence and stillness where they're alone, and there's this profound sense of grace that comes through. It's hard to describe. It's beautiful for me.
An Elephant Sitting Still is unrated at Lemley's Glendale Theater. Legend of the Demon Cat, a fantasy horror film from writer-director Chen Kaiga. Amy?
Well, I mean, this movie had me at Demon Cat. It's about a black cat who shows up in ancient China and tells this young wife, follow me, I know where there's a bunch of money. And she finds the money, and then life just gets very, very bad for her. This is one of those big, beautiful, very CG, very colorful epics that you're probably picturing. But it's more of a ghost story than, say, an action film. You know, there is a lot of, like, running. Cats are very balletic, of course. There's a lot of blood. There's a lot of murder. And what I found myself really drawn to is that this is a film that has just tons of imagination. There's a big subplot when you have this sort of bald detective from Japan who shows up to help figure out why people are getting murdered and is there really such a thing as a demon cat. He's very skeptical about magic. And from this point on, there's a ton of magicians who get invented who create imaginary melons and turn themselves into cranes. There's beautiful, like, birthday celebrations where women are on trapezes and people are turning themselves into fish in the sky. Like, if you could explain to me what this movie's about, great. I would love that.
But it's a spectacle.
It's an absolute spectacle. And then what it becomes about in the very end is it actually does become very emotional about the way, like, certain people in this society are abused or discarded, the way one might treat a stray cat, for example. And I found myself touched by how sad it got. I was not expecting it to take this turn. You know, the films from this period right now that we're doing in China, they are so shiny and so CG heavy. This is definitely one of them where you're kind of rolling your eyes like, please take place somehow on Earth. And the emotions do, even if the look of it is just absolute mayhem.
Is this comparable at all to Kaiga's other work, or standalone, do you think?
You know, I'm not that familiar with his other work, to be honest. Justin, you are, right?
Somewhat. It's been a while. I haven't kept up with his work as much as I, you know, could. This sounds definitely like a much more acceleration into the CG, although I think that has been a trend across Chinese film.
Yeah, and I haven't thought of that as sort of his style of the past. But I could be wrong in that. Yeah. Legend of the Demon Cat is unrated. It's at the Downtown Independent Theater. And finally, the biographical drama about Motley Crue, The Dirt, which stars Douglas Booth, Iwan Rheon, and Machine Gun Kelly. It's directed by Jeff Tremaine. Amy?
I have been very curious about this movie for a very long time because I remember reading The Dirt, the biography that this movie is based on when it came out. And what was special about The Dirt is that it's this autobiography narrated by all four different members of Motley Crue, so that it was able to kind of break the fourth wall and say, well, these people disagree. They would have one chapter, then somebody would come along and rebut that chapter and say, this is how it really happened. And then it was punctuated with, you know, crazy real life stories, like the time that Ozzy Osbourne snorted a line of ants at a hotel pool, which did happen and which did make it into the film. I was kind of wishing this film had been made maybe back then, because it is not a film that feels very of today. It's very regressive in its politics. The book is regressive about a time that was regressive. Every girl in here is either topless or mean, the source of all evil in the world, from the mothers to the ex-girlfriends. There's a moment where it does try to get into the darkness of, say, Tommy Lee punching one of his fiancées, but the movie does everything it can to make her deserve it up until that point. And I found myself, as much as I love Motley Crue's music, to be honest, I really, really do, and as much as I love the party atmosphere of sequences where, say, Machine Gun Kelly, who plays Tommy Lee, and plays Tommy Lee kind of like an Energizer Bunny. He's just bouncing around and very cheerful. He narrates a day in his life, just the drunken chaos and not understanding what's happening and the strippers he vomits on. And when the movie goes into that zone, it's almost more fun. But then at the same time I was watching this entire movie, I kept thinking, well, it's better than Bohemian Rhapsody, to be honest. And, you know, the second half, when all of their bad behavior catches up to them, actually gets pretty strong. You know, the center here is Douglas Booth as Nikki Six. He's the darkest of the group. I guess I just couldn't really separate myself from the fact that it was written by Neil Strauss, who is the person who started the game and then started the men's rights movement. And if you know that and you see these girls, it's really dark.
The Dirt is unrated and it's streaming on Netflix. ...1968 was a tumultuous year in America, including on screen. Sam Peckinpah's revolutionary Western, The Wild Bunch, was filmed during 1968's upheaval and tragedy. The violence of the Vietnam War and assassinations were reflected in the movie's shocking images. The Wild Bunch is a movie that shocks even those of us rewatching it today. In honor of the 50th anniversary of the film's release, journalist W.K. Stratton is offering new scholarship on the film. His book, The Wild Bunch, Sam Peckinpah, A Revolution in Hollywood and the Making of a Legendary Film. Kip, good to have you with us today.
Oh, it's so great to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's go back and listen to a scene from the film. In this scene, William Holden, as Pike Bishop, reprimands his bunch for wanting to desert old Freddie Sykes, played by Edmund O'Brien.
What in the hell's the matter with you, old man? Leave him alone! Oh. He's gonna get us all killed. I'm gonna get rid of him.
You better not get rid of anybody. We're gonna stick together just like it used to be. When you side with a man, you stay with him, and if you can't do that, you're like some animal. You're finished. We're finished. All of us!
I love that scene because, to me, Kip, that brings up the intensity of the film that's there almost start to finish. It was truly a revolutionary movie.
Oh, it really was. It changed so many things about how films are made, particularly in the way violence is portrayed. But it had a lot of other elements to it that I think that have really made it a classic. And these relationships between men and who aren't very good men at all. There's no one in a white hat in this Western at all. Far from it. These are bad, bad men who at the end do something to redeem themselves. And it's presented in not a very pleasant way, but a very realistic way that, as you said, really reflects the times that it was filmed.
Peckinpah himself is such a fascinating character. His early work in television and really coming up as the medium is coming of age, working in Westerns, moving to feature films. And I remember, you know, people sometimes ask, well, why some of your movies, particularly The Wild Bunch, so violent? And he mentioned Junior Bomber and said, well, I made this sweet little, you know, relational story. No one went to see it. But I'm a fan of Junior Bomber as well, which is probably my favorite or second favorite Peckinpah film. But he's known for this one.
Yes. And in fact, I think Junior Bomber is an underappreciated masterpiece of a film. Certainly Steve McQueen's best acting is in that film, and it is starting to get more attention these days, and I'm glad to see that.
I'm glad. Ida Lupino with her comeback as his mom.
Robert Preston completely out of type in the role that he plays and does a magnificent job. It's just a wonderful film. Cinema Verite film during the actual rodeo in Prescott. Yeah. Just amazing stuff.
And speaking of, you know, being at the scene where it's filmed, The Wild Bunch, filmed in Mexico, uses large numbers of Mexican actors in the film. Seems to me there it wasn't just the themes of the movie, but even how it was cast was a reflection of a change in Hollywood.
Well, I think so, and I think it actually was ahead of its time in that regard. The film was largely shot in Parras in southern Coahuila in Mexico, which was the hometown of Francisco Madero, the father of the Mexican Revolution. So the scenery you saw there was very significant in historical terms. A lot of faces of people from that part of Mexico just appear in this picture. It gets you a real sense of place that most American moviegoers hadn't visited before. And then it has a large number of characters who are from Mexico, and every actor who filled one of those roles was a Latino. Most were Mexicans or Mexican-Americans, and then Jaime Sanchez, playing Angel, was a Puerto Rican who grew up on Mexican music and Mexican film. So it was kind of a natural thing for him to take on this role. I can't think of a picture from Hollywood before The Wild Bunch that had that many Mexican characters that were all filled by Latinos, the parts. And that was really a breakthrough. And it's gone relatively unappreciated, I think. But it's important from that reason, that standpoint.
We're talking about the film The Wild Bunch on its 50th anniversary, W.K. Stratton's new book, The Wild Bunch, Sam Peckinpah, A Revolution in Hollywood, and the Making of a Legendary Film. How much of an influence do you think Bonnie and Clyde was on this movie?
Well, it was a big influence. There was violence portrayed in Bonnie and Clyde using squibs to make gunshots look realistic. And then there was the ending sequence where Bonnie and Clyde meet their doom that was filmed in slow motion. And that was not lost on Peckinpah. He told some of his associates that he wanted to, quote, cut Bonnie and Clyde with his film The Wild Bunch, take it one step further. And he did. There's a lot more slow motion in The Wild Bunch, and it's used even more effectively than the slow motion in Bonnie and Clyde. And the squib technology, Peckinpah advanced that by squibbing an actor who was getting shot both in the front and the back so that you would have the impression of a bullet going through a body. And to make it even more realistic, they would put a little bit of hamburger meat on the squib on the backside of the actor. So you actually saw something fly
like
out.
Like flesh leaving the body with the shot.
Right. And you know, Peckinpah never liked the way violence had been portrayed in all these Westerns, like Gunsmoke, for instance, where Matt Dillon killed dozens and dozens of people, and it never seemed to have any consequences. And he wanted to make violence seem real, that there was a consequence when you killed somebody, and that it was not pretty, it was dirty. And he was, I think, very successful in that.
Well, and you have a Hollywood that is trying to find itself. In previous years, box office had been in decline with television taking much of the audience. And how difficult a sell was it for Peckinpah to do a film with this much explicit violence? Or did the studio even know?
Well, the producer, Phil Feldman, was excited by the violence in it. He thought it was groundbreaking, Peckinpah and Feldman had their differences eventually, but in this regard, they were sort of on the same page. Feldman thought this was groundbreaking. This is a way to push the barriers of the 1960s. So his producer was all for it, as was the office in Burbank at Warner Brothers. They were okay with this. So he had support for what he was doing, which was kind of rare for a Sam Peckinpah film.
Pauline Kael, a big supporter of the film early on, obviously a very influential critic. But were there critics who couldn't get past the violence?
Absolutely. Perhaps the best known was Rex Reed, who thought it was a terrible movie, you know, should not have been made because of the violence. The reviewer for Reader's Digest wondered, should this movie have ever been made? However, they were offset by mostly younger critics like Roger Ebert, who proclaimed the film a masterpiece from the get-go, Jay Cox at Time Magazine, and others who saw that Peckinpah had really accomplished something special here.
The casting is such an important part of this film, and using actors like Bill Holden and Ernest Borgnine and others, you know, sort of later in their careers, this must have been a conscious effort. Was part of it, though, that was there any problem with casting for the film because of the themes it pushed?
I don't know that there was problems with casting the film because of the themes it pushed. The picture started out as a project with Lee Marvin playing the lead in it.
Then Marvin
eventually dropped out. He was, of course, a close friend of Sam Peckinpah's and had worked with him before. And then they went through a number of actors trying to find a replacement for the lead role and settled on William Holden, who was in a pretty dark period of his life. He'd killed a man in a traffic accident while driving drunk the year before, and his career was headed south, definitely. And he needed something to revive it. And, man, the performance he gave in The Wild Bunch was just incredible.
Well, and then the film roles that would come after this, after the revival of his career through this film.
He became relevant to a whole new generation.
He did. Terrific actor. We're talking about The Wild Bunch. Sam Peckinpah, A Revolution in Hollywood and the Making of a Legendary Film. Journalist W.K. Stratton with us to talk about his book, which is published on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the classic Western, which revolutionized the form. As we continue, we'll talk about the ways in which it did just that. You're listening to KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle as we enjoy music from the soundtrack of Sam Peckinpah's classic Western, The Wild Bunch, released 50 years ago this year. The new book, The Wild Bunch, Sam Peckinpah, A Revolution in Hollywood and the Making of a Legendary Film, written by our guest W.K. Stratton. Let's listen to another scene from the film, this a bit of comic relief from Posse members T.C., played by L.Q. Jones, and Coffer, played by Strother Martin, as they fight over who they killed and who gets the victim's belongings.
You stupid damn fools! Why did you shoot this employee and let the others get away?
Why did you that employee? I first shot kill this man right here!
Liar! He's shooting that employee full of holes. Why, I was dropping this band.
And them others, too.
Why, I must have killed all three of them.
You must have killed all three of them? What do you think you did? I found that three for you, spot.
Liar! Black liar!
You shouldn't talk like that to me.
I'm sorry. Come on, TC. Help me get his boots.
Peckinpah using humor, which maybe works all the better because of how startling the violence can be, Kip.
Yeah, and I think at the end, once the final shootout has occurred and the main characters are no longer with us, as the movie ends, there's a lot of laughter. And the message I took from that was, you know, the world is a hard place, and sometimes all we can do is laugh at our own foibles. And it's like the use of laughter in the film is great, and humor. You know, Peckinpah was very well-read, very well-educated director. And he knew his Aristotle, and he also knew his Shakespeare. And he knew if you're dealing with tragic themes, you had to add some humor to make it work, just like Shakespeare understood that.
Peckinpah had a number of personal challenges of his own. He died at the age of, I think it was 59 when he died.
Correct.
So as a young man when he died. at this point in his life, with the huge responsibility of a large cast like this and a lot of complexity in the making of this film, what kind of shape was he in?
Well, he was already beginning to show the effects of lifelong alcoholism virtually, and he was having some health problems that he pushed through in order to get the picture made. He was proving F. Scott Fitzgerald wrong during this time, in that he showed that America sometimes does have second acts. He had been banned from directing, essentially, by Hollywood.
Because of his behavior?
Because of his behavior, difficult to get along with in his drinking. And he suddenly had this chance to direct this picture, and Warner Brothers gave him this chance. So it was make it or break it time for him. And he came through successfully. So he did have a second act. And he went on to make some terrific films, Junior Bonner, one of them, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, so on and so forth.
Yeah, and revival of his career as well. What do you see as the immediate influence on other Westerns in this era where the Western itself starts getting perceived as a tired genre?
Well, I think you look at the other great revisionist Western from the time that came out a few years later, McCabe and Mrs. Miller from Robert Altman, an amazing film, an amazing feminist Western, I consider it. You look at that film and you can see the influence of Peckinpah, even though maybe Altman would never admit that. But in the scene in which Keith Carradine's character is shot down in slow motion and the whole way that is filmed, that's using a vocabulary, film vocabulary, that Sam Peckinpah created in The Wild Bunch. So you keep seeing this in movies going forward, particularly in those revisionist westerns of the 70s. These things Peckinpah just brought out for the first time in The Wild Bunch.
With the interviews that you conducted from people who were involved in the production, what was some of the sense that they captured of what the set was like on the film from day to day?
Well, it was intense. There was a lot of work. People put in a lot of hard hours in situations that were not comfortable. A lot of dust, a lot of noise, a lot of heat. Then at night, it would be, as it is in the desert, it could be bone-chilling cold, all within 24 hours. Tough times. But Warren Oates articulated it the best, I think. He said, as soon as we got down there and started working, we realized we were doing something special. And everyone I talked to had that feeling that this was something special that was going on here. And people from crew members through the actors, they did their best. And because they understood something was happening here.
And what did they say gave them that sense? Was it the chemistry of the actors? Was it the vision that Peckinpah had, his clarity? What was it that gave them this impression that this was going to be a film to make a mark?
Well, Sam certainly had a vision for this, and that it came out, and they knew that he was leading them in a direction. And then he managed to put together an amazing crew and an amazing set of actors who are all playing off each other. And they realized just how good they all were. And I think that's what really propelled them in the filming of this picture. And then afterwards, when Lou Lombardo and his other film cutters were working on editing it, they understood too. And they put their best into it, worked ungodly hours, getting this thing cut. The picture has more than 3,600 edits in it, which is a record for a color movie. It's incredible if you think how many edits are in this picture.
It's still a record?
Still a record, as far as we know.
And did Peckinpah, was he heavily controlling the editing himself, or did the editor have much latitude on the film?
Well, Lou Lombardo had brought a lot of editing genius into the cutting room, but Peckinpah was there for the whole ride. He said he saw every frame of film shot for this picture, and there were miles and miles of film shot for this. But he was intimately involved, but he had this great partner in Lou Lombardo.
What was the response from the sort of American traditionalist Western, the John Ford, John Wayne? How did they respond to this movie?
You know, it was really mixed. A lot of people saw this as the next logical step in the development of the Western. Others didn't care for it that much because they saw it as somewhat subversive. There was no one who did anything heroic.
Yeah, really. Who do you root for?
Right, right. You have the heroes, quote unquote, are really, really bad men. Men behaving badly, beyond badly. They're murderers. They're thieves. They're all of these bad things. And so it was really mixed in that audience, in that world. As time has gone on, you know, it's come to be considered in that world as one of the great classic Westerns, if not the best Western, which I consider it to be the best Western myself.
It's number one on your list, above The Searchers or some of the other classic
films.
Yeah,
with all respect.
Red River.
With all respect to those, the totality of the picture, I think it's just beyond them.
All right. Thank you so much, Kip. Appreciate your coming in, talking about this film, which, by the way, is on the American Film Institute's list of 100 best American films. Sam Peckinpah's classic of 1969 release, The Wild Bunch. W.K. Stratton's book, The Wild Bunch. Sam Peckinpah, A Revolution in Hollywood, and the Making of a Legendary Film. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week, our critics, and me, Larry Mantle. Thank you so much for joining us.